Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now is my good friend, Brian Clark, a retired United States Navy commander and former submariner who is now with the Hudson Institute think tank, where he has been exceptionally busy working three important reports. One of the three assessments of the United States Navy that went into the Pentagon's Office of Cost Analysis and Program Evaluation. Also was part of the team that produced two other reports, one on 5G technology, the other one on sustaining America's anti-submarine warfare advantage. And all three of these reports were put together with his colleagues, Seth Cropsey and Tim Walton. Brian, it's always great having you on. Thanks very much for joining us. And I can't believe you must be really relieved to have brought all three of them across the finish line.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, it's great to be on. And it is great to have these reports all in the can, if you will. The 5G report came out today. And the anti-submarine warfare report came out last week. The future fleet study will come out officially in about a week and a half, it looks like. That's when the publication people will be done with it. We're really excited about it.
I'm sorry, I'm jumping the gun a little bit. You know, you and I talked about the anti-submarine report while it was in the works, and then also got your thoughts about the force structure report, and the official name of that is American Sea Power at a Crossroads, a plan to restore the U.S. Navy's maritime advantage. Let's start there, right? I mean, one of the points you made earlier this year in a congressional hearing was that the Navy's big problem was that it lacks a clear theory of victory. And you note in the report that the Navy's had 20 years launching all number of major programs, the littoral combat ship, the Ford class, the Zumwalt, and these have not really been distinguished with an enormous amount of success at this point. Navy going to a new frigate, our sponsor Fincantieri Marinette Marine is going to be building that ship. And you note that that this is sort of a once-in-a-century moment for the Navy for both peril and opportunity. Talk to us about the recommendations you made in your report and how your report contrasted with the other two reports that went into CAPE that in turn drove where Dr. Esper ended up in terms of the force structure that he has dictated the Navy needs.
Right, Bago. So we provided one of the three inputs to the future naval force study that was recently completed and briefed out to the SECDEF, as you noted. The other two studies were from the Navy. They presented a fleet architecture proposal, and CAPE presented one of their own as well. Our fleet really tried to expand upon some of the advantages that we've talked about before with regard to decision-centric warfare, and I can talk a little bit more of that in a second, but to try to distribute the fleet more, to try to give it more complexity that'll make an adversary have a tougher time trying to understand how it's operating and be able to defeat it in detail, and also try to improve the fleet's resilience and ability to be sustained over time, which gets to both cost and logistics. And so cost, we saw, was a very significant driver for our fleet. I would say that the other two fleets that were presented, the Navy's represented a little bit more of a traditional vision with a larger number of traditional large multi-mission combatants. And then CAPE's was probably somewhere in between, between the Navy's approach and our approach at Hudson. The theory of victory, I think, was an important consideration when we designed our fleet. Because one thing we found over the last few years or the last few cycles of Navy force structure assessments is they've all been sort of based on just doing a modeling and simulation analysis of future warfighting scenarios where you make a bunch of assumptions of how that's going to happen. And then you evaluate, well, what do you need to be able to essentially win a war of attrition against an opponent like a China or Russia or an Iran in those situations? And that tends to drive you to a fleet that's really designed with a lot of big platforms that are able to, fight it out in a fight that's more about how many salvos you can launch at each other in short order than it is about defining a strategy or pursuing a strategy for victory. And that gets the theory of victory. So we think that the Navy's theory of victory needs to be much more about this decision-centric approach. Like if you're a status quo power, you are fundamentally trying to prevent other opponents from being successful in their acts of aggression. So you got to present uncertainty to them about their likelihood of success. And the way to do that is to create a lot of a complex force structure that's got lots of options available to it, that's able to survive an initial attack and therefore is resilient, and then is able to erode your enemy's ability to succeed sufficiently so that he can't win. And if he can't win, then that's a win for us because we're really not looking to take anybody over. So that theory of victory we thought was sort of essential to guiding the fleet construct.
And where does that take you in terms of the types of assets that you need? Obviously, the aircraft carrier sort of hogs up the largest amount of bandwidth in this debate. Concerns, for example, the Navy hasn't been investing in the kinds of long-range air power to keep it relevant. It's still the core organizing construct of the fleet. Walk us through, you know, the carrier we need, the air wing we need to make that platform relevant, right? I mean, there's nothing inherently about the carrier that's problematic. Well, there are some elements of the problem, but in general, you know, it's good to have an airfield that can move around to 30 plus knots over prolonged periods of time. But, you know, how does that fit into the overall kind of architecture? What are the other warships, the other unmanned capabilities we need in order to sort of maintain the advantage against a very, very committed adversary that now has hit the 355 ship goal before the U.S. Navy has?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the if you look at, you know, some of the canonical war fights that we traditionally analyze, like China versus Taiwan or China invading Taiwan, or even China trying to take some islands from Japan or the Philippines. So essentially the power projection by the Chinese in their near abroad. Those situations, if you want to present sufficient uncertainty to the Chinese that they're going to be successful, well, then you got to be able to threaten enough of their fleet and enough of their places ashore in the littoral area so that they feel like the chances of success are sufficiently low that they're not going to be willing to exercise that attack today, and they put it off until they think, you know, the opportunity presents itself. So we found in the analysis of that, that situation, the carrier actually, if you rely on the carrier for most of your power projection on the part of the U.S. Navy, you're presenting the adversary with less uncertainty because they understand how a carrier works. It's a very concentrated source of firepower. By pushing it far enough away using anti-ship ballistic missiles and forcing it to run around to avoid being attacked, you've really reduced its ability to generate sorties sufficiently so that now you can drive on through and achieve your objective because the carrier is not going to be able to present sufficient fires to prevent you, from taking Taiwan, from taking some island from the Japanese or the Philippines. So the carrier by itself, that approach, does not lend sufficient complexity or uncertainty to an adversary. So we've got to spread out the firepower. So we found that you need to balance fires from the carrier with fires from surface combatants that can go in and launch large salvos in short periods of time, and then also submarines that are able to go inside of a denied area or a contested area and launch salvos either deep inland, but more importantly, to launch salvos from locations that the enemy is not looking, so that creating that uncertainty. So early in a conflict, we found you're likely to have the submarines and the surface combatants delivering a lot of your anti-ship and strike fires. And then as the fight progresses, the carrier might, will deliver a larger fraction of those as the enemy's defenses start to either be depleted or destroyed in some kind of attack. So that you have this ebb and flow of who's providing most of your offensive firepower. But that means early on in the conflict, the carrier's role is much more about sea control and about protecting those surface combatants and submarines and marine littoral units that are ashore in the first island chain, for example. And then it transitions to be more the traditional carrier role of doing both protection, sea control and power projection. So you need both. And so what that does with the fleet mix is you have to increase the number of surface combatants you have that are able to deliver fires so you can spread them out and then rotate them through so that you can sustain fires. And then you need sufficient submarines to go deliver these fires at least early on, but you don't need a huge submarine force because at a certain point, the submarine is going to have difficulty operating effectively once it's being looked for. And then you might be able to get by with a smaller number of carriers because their role has changed from being the primary power projection asset to being one that does sea control and power projection and is complemented to a large degree by the surface fleet. So that ends up driving the fleet balance towards maybe a smaller number of carriers. We saw 9 as being the right number in the 2045 timeframe. And then it drives up the number of surface combatants, particularly small surface combatants that can act as these missile carriers, which we saw going up to about 55 small surface combat like frigates and LCSs, complemented by another 60 to 70 corvettes that would be used instead of the Navy's large surface combatant or large unmanned surface vehicle. And then the submarine fleet ends up being about the same.
Right. Your submarine design assumes that we build through the bathtub, right? So we have to get to a higher rate of production so that we don't end up with that 44 ship fleet that's our worst case number. You know what I mean? You very rapidly end up with a much smaller submarine force by easing off the throttles even a little bit on your build rate.
So the challenge with the build rate is increasing the build rate takes away money that would otherwise go to the amphibious fleet or the surface fleet. At a time when you're trying to build new families of small ships, so small amphibious ships, the LAW, small surface combatants, in our case, the corvette, or the Navy's case, the large unmanned surface vehicle, and the frigate. So when you actually build the shipbuilding plan and try to stay below the limit that we set for ourselves, which is PV21 plus inflation, you're not able to increase the submarine build rate, really. You can keep it about where it is, you can keep it at the point it is, which is 2 per year. But during Columbia, especially, there just isn't any room in the shipbuilding budget to afford an increase in the submarine build rate. So what we did was we took into account the fact that Navy will be refueling some of the Los Angeles class submarines to try to fill in a little bit of the bathtub. We expected that the submarines, though, then would have, you would have a reduction in the submarine force size in the midterm, not as much as what's currently planned, but, a reduction. And then you don't get back up to the requirement of 60 until the late 2030s, I believe. So that's one problem. Now, I will say one of the things we found in the analysis is that the role of the submarine is going to be different going forward than we have presumed, over the last 30 years. Our assumptions have been that the submarine will be the platform that goes inside these contested areas and can operate with relative impunity to do anti-ship attacks or strikes. That's not really going to be the case going forward because Russia and China and even other countries have started to invest in their own ASW capability. So if China has a SOSUS-like system and you have a submarine driving around, launching torpedoes or missiles, well, that's quickly going to be located and then suppressed. So we're not going to lose submarines necessarily in that fight, but they're going to be unable to continue doing that mission. So we don't necessarily need the submarines to be a large component of the power projection, but we need them to do this kind of niche mission at the beginning and then probably withdraw so they can do sea control in support of the rest of the fleet.
Let me ask you two more Navy questions, because then I want to get your sense on the 5G report that was important, and then the final anti-submarine warfare report as well. How did Commandant Berger's, Marine Corps Commandant Berger's revised approach to war in the Pacific and a greater focus on China in particular, and a much more flexible composition of expeditionary marine forces and amphibious forces shape your design?
That was fascinating. So the work that they've done on the Marine Corps has been terrific. They've been wargaming very aggressively to evaluate how this, what is now called the Marine Littoral Regiment, how they would operate. I think what we found in our own analysis is that, and then some of the work the Marine Corps has done, is that those units are probably best suited to do ISR, counter-ISR, and air defense missions, and potentially some surface attack or strike missions, but that's sort of a secondary mission to these primary ones of ISR, counter-ISR, and air defense. The reason being that if they can use short-range air defenses to constrain the freedom of movement of bombers coming over, for example, the First Island Chain, you've forced the Chinese to invest in air defense suppression, which is not a mission that they've been having to spend money on over the last 30 years. So it creates this new demand for escorts, suppression aircraft, electronic warfare aircraft that do the things that we've been having to do over the last 30 years since the Cold War ended. And then those units can also do a lot of ISR and counter-ISR. So what we found in terms of the implications for the fleet are you essentially need two pieces to your amphibious force. One piece is the littoral, the light amphibious warships, the littoral the Marine Littoral Regiments will use these light amphibious warships to move around within the First Island Chain and be supported by the laws. And then the laws in turn will be supported by the LPD LSD class warships, your amphibious transport dock, amphibious landing dock. And then that's going to be the other part of the fleet. And then you've separately from that, you have the large deck amphib, which will essentially act mostly as an F-35 Bravo carrier to provide fires to those Marines that are ashore when they need extra fires and, you know, force protection, or because they have a target they need to engage that they don't have the fires to do organically. So that ends up being your mix. You've got the, you know, the large amphib ships of today forming one part of the amphibious fleet, the LAWs and the Marine Littoral Regiments forming the other, and then they operate, you know, synergistically, essentially. And what we found is in the highest contested areas, the larger amphibious ships will probably operate farther back, and they'll use the air cover provided by the carrier to help do sea control around them.
Let me ask you about the final product that, I mean, obviously Dr. Esper hasn't released the granular details, obviously a lot of debate and discussion in naval circles on his final architecture. What's your verdict of where he came up and a little bit of the criticism that while some of the numbers and the conclusions may be right, that the resourcing is not going to be there given all the other things the Navy has got to do? Where do you fall on the grading of the product that you helped contribute to?
What was provided to the Secretary, as I understand it, because we participated in the process, was the three fleet alternatives and then an assessment essentially of how they performed in the scenarios of the war games and the tabletop exercises that we did. And then some, you know, insights from that to say, well, here's some elements of the fleet that would be really useful, and here's some, you know, numbers ranges. So it was essentially a set of insights from the analysis, not a answer. Because the three fleets, none of those fleet architectures was necessarily the right answer. They all formed, you know, kind of parts or boundary conditions, you know, within which you would evaluate the trade space. So my understanding is that what would be provided back to the Navy is some guidance to say, we've done this analysis, we evaluated these three fleets, here's the things we learned about, you know, here's maybe the number of submarines that is, you know, a minimum, and here's maybe the number that's the maximum you can achieve. You know, here's what I would like to see in terms of, you know, the number of carriers and other platforms in terms of like ranges. I don't get the impression that there was an intent for the Secretary to give the Navy back an exact number for each ship class, but to instead give them guidance that would bound essentially the Navy's analysis. So the Navy would have some freedom to come up with the final answer within its own analysis. That was my understanding of how this was going to proceed. So right now it should be on its way back to the Navy this week. Now I will say one thing is the fiscal constraints were something we really pushed in the analytic process that should to be addressed, both shipbuilding costs and ONS costs, operation and sustainment costs, because traditionally the Navy will stay within its SCN limits, but then buy a fleet that's too expensive to own, and then money has to come out of the shipbuilding account to pay for the readiness. So we really pushed for ONS costs to be a constraint that was placed on the fleet. And I don't think that survived contact with the analytic process. So I suspect what's been provided back to the Navy and what the Navy might in turn generate is going to be too expensive from a ONS perspective, even if it is going to fall within the strict PB21 plus inflation cost limit for SCN.
Let's move on to the 5G report. You guys released that on Tuesday, called Weaponizing the 5G Value Chain, which sounds terrifying, frankly. Obviously, everybody regards 5G as not only an important commercial and civil enabling technology, but also something with very, very powerful national security repercussions. At the end of the day, the Trump administration has been fighting a campaign against Huawei and ZTE, although the criticism, and I think you make this point, is the administration doesn't so much have a broader 5G strategy as how do we stop Huawei and ZTE. And I commend people to read the report, because Huawei is innovating in its own right, right? I mean, there's this perception that they just stole the technology, whereas actually their hardware is really good. Their operating costs and ownership costs are relatively low, and their sales price is relatively low. At the same time, it does present certain challenges. As you look at the ecosystem, right, and you also talk about a high-low mix in there, which I thought was interesting, where are we, where do we need to be, how do we get there? So what are the key takeaways?
Thanks, Rago. So on the 5G study, when we did the analysis, one thing that jumped out at us was that Huawei is essentially like IBM with the PC market of the early 90s, late 80s. You know, so they provide a fully integrated turnkey solution that performs well and is low cost. You know, so for a network operator, working with Huawei is really attractive because they've got a track record of having deployed 5G in a lot of places. They can come to you and say, completely turnkey, we'll build this thing, turn it over to you at the end, and then we'll help you with the maintenance and sustainment of the network afterward. So it's a very attractive option. And counter to what a lot of you hear, like you noted from some of the critics, Huawei's equipment performs pretty well. So it's efficient. They use GaN technology, so gallium nitride semiconductor technology to improve its efficiency. So it's efficient. It has low total cost of ownership because it's got the power efficiency. And they can take advantage of subsidies from the Chinese government, obviously, to help cover the cost of providing low cost integrated solutions for their customers. So that's the situation. And I guess I would argue that the administration has actually started the effort at countering that with a, as you noted, not a very strategic approach, but a relatively effective one for the near term. So the export controls that the Trump administration put in place on semiconductor technology that's from the United States, so design technology and some of the manufacturing equipment that comes from the U.S. has been prevented from being used to build semiconductors that would be sold to Huawei. So Huawei can't get access to the best semiconductors that they've depended upon to put in their top line flagship 5G phones, and also to put into their new 5G antenna and network architecture. So right now, Huawei is prevented from continuing this build out of the 5G networks they've been constructing for network operators. And they're also prevented from making the enormous returns they make off of their handset business. So this tactic of the export controls is pretty effective at slowing Huawei's role in terms of becoming a dominant 5G player. The problem is Huawei will eventually construct a supply base in China or with third parties that will circumvent these export controls. So we have a couple of years before that happens. And so the question is, okay, what are we doing for those couple of years to try to cement a lead on the part of a Western alternative to Huawei? The reason why we think this is really important is that Huawei is becoming the dominant 5G player right now. They provide most of the 5G equipment in the world. They provide more than anybody else, I guess, to put that more clearly. And what that does is that even if we keep Huawei's equipment out of U.S. networks, there will be so much Huawei equipment in outside the U.S. networks that any U.S. communications that travel outside the U.S. Network domain and go to like a European network for a brief time or a Mexican network for a brief time, which often happens, whether it's a domestic communication or an international one, sometimes there's a leakage because the network is trying to be managed efficiently. So then we're going to have this exposure to Huawei equipment, whether we keep it out of U.S. systems or not. So we think it's really important that we have viable U.S. or Western 5G providers to start to erode Huawei's ability to dominate the 5G hardware space.
And what does that look like, right? I mean, so you talked about, our policy has been very prescriptive, which is, and effectively threaten our closest allies and partners, some of which are our closest intelligence partners. And at the end of the day, how do we need to harness the Ericssons, the Nokias, and other qualified manufacturers out there? I had suggested at some point that it might make sense to build sort of a global consortium, bring the Japanese into it, right? I mean, sort of free-minded nations, democratic nations, all sort of working together to be competitive worldwide, right? I mean, otherwise you're just going to have to subsidize in, which is what the Chinese government is doing, right? So, I mean, what is that global footprint looks like, and what's the value of having, as you noted, that sort of high-low strategy in that mix?
Right. So I would step back a little bit to say, before we can get to having some a viable consortium or viable alternative players for 5G, you've got to have an alternative network architecture that's going to compete. And the problem right now is we can talk all we want about wanting Nokia or Ericsson or somebody else to come in and take the 5G business from Huawei. They don't have an offering that competes effectively with Huawei, partly because Huawei's being subsidized, but partly because the equipment they have is just not where Huawei is, and the service they are they have is not where Huawei is. That's why we mounted the high-low strategy. So the idea is we would advocate attacking Huawei's value chain at the high end and low end, but with some targeted U.S. investments that create the technologies and the integrators that you need to be able to facilitate the international consortium that you talked about. So before you get to that consortium, you've got to do some work with the hardware, and you've got to do some work with the third parties that will make it possible. And so how that works is the 5G network consists basically of two parts: the radio network, which is what interacts with your mobile phone, and then the core network, which is the telecommunication network that the radio network talks to and that then connects everybody across the world. The high part of the strategy is to facilitate the emergence of cloud-based providers for that high part of the network. The core network for 5G and the core network for all telecommunications is moving towards a cloud-based structure where most of the machinery is virtualized. This idea of the virtual digital twin that we're looking at in Department of Defense, that's happening in the telecommunications world too. So these core networks are increasingly just being built with software on cloud computing platforms. So we have to facilitate the emergence of that because the US has a strong advantage in that area. That's the high part of the strategy. Huawei is not really good at that part of that network yet. They have a relatively primitive core network approach, and they don't take advantage of any of the services that you can get by having a cloud-based core network for 5G. So that's an open opportunity for the US and European players to jump in there and take advantage of. At the low part of the strategy, we would compete directly with Huawei in the radio access network that is kind of Huawei's bread and butter. So we need to facilitate the emergence of highly integrated alternatives to Huawei's highly integrated radio network that can perform comparably on cost, are able to be provided by Western or non-Huawei provider. So that's where some investments go into what's called Open RAN. So the Open Radio Access Network is basically creating a open architecture version of like what Huawei does in a more integrated form. So from a PC, the PC comparison would be Huawei is the IBM PC of 1990. And we're offering the Dell PC of 1993, which is the open architecture PC, where you buy all the parts from other players, and then Dell's an integrator. So what we need is, well, who's the integrator for these open architecture networks that Nokia or Ericsson or whomever might do? So Nokia and Ericsson can do it, ideally you'd have third parties that do that, and there are some companies that are moving into that business now. So the low part of the strategy facilitates the emergence of, the open architecture version of the radio access network that can compete with Huawei on performance and be cheaper on cost because it's the Dell PC of computers.
And we've only got about 2 minutes left. Talk to us about any other takeaways and anything you didn't say about the anti-submarine warfare report when last we spoke. I should tell people the title of it is Sustaining the Undersea Advantage, Disrupting Anti-Submarine Warfare Using Autonomous Systems. Any other takeaways or points you want to bring to the audience who should be looking up your report and reading it?
Well, so the big takeaway, Vago, is that the ASW mission is we've been doing the same way for about the last 30 years when it comes down to it. And it's very cost intensive. It's very manpower intensive. It's open to disruption, like a lot of other businesses in the world today, by a digital competitor. So in this case, we see unmanned systems as being uniquely suited to perform most of the ASW mission. They already perform some of it. You think of SOSIS as an unmanned system. There's a lot of unmanned capabilities that could be brought to bear to do most of the ASW mission and free up our multi-mission destroyers, our P-8s, our submarines to go do other things or to act as the command and control platform for these ASW missions and reduce the cost of the missions and reduce their reduce the burden they place on these multi-mission platforms and their crews. What we found is that if you mount this approach, it is cheaper, so much cheaper than the current approach, that it generally pays for itself in about a year of ASW operations.
Wow. I find it interesting that Cold War era friends used to tell me all the time, we used to practice a lot at ASW and were really bad and regularly saw green dye all around us at the end of these exercises. And just imagine how much less good we are today when we haven't been operating for decades, right, with this as a focus. I know the Navy has stepped up its, right, its focus over the last couple of years, you know, I would say last half decade or so. But it certainly would be interesting to see whether or not, you know, it's certainly a market, right, in Silicon Valley terms, that's ripe for reinvention, right?
Right. Yeah, and so one big thing I would say, the big change is that we need to think of this instead of killing submarines as suppressing submarines. So if the mission is really just keeping the submarine from being successful, you think back to Greyhound just came out, you know, with Tom Hanks. So there was not as much sinking of submarines there as just harassing submarines to make them go away. and that was the success of the Battle of the Atlantic. So we argue that, well, let's take the same approach here and focus on suppressing submarines, shoot them as many times as you have to make them go away. Just figure out how to, you know, what's the cheaper thing you can shoot them with other than a Mark 48 or a Mark 54.
Exactly. Brian, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks for so very much for spending so much time with us and joining us as often as you do. Always a terrific pleasure, and already looking forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Fago. It was great talking to you. Appreciate it.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.